Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 1st of August, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Brad Benow, and he will be speaking on shame, toxic or healthy. So let's listen in on Brad.
And for us to get started, I'm Brad Benow. I teach pastoral theology on the faculty of Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. Here in my second week of doing things at Holden, my wife and Anne and I did Bible study last week, and this week she's doing some things on feminist theology and the Reimagining Conference and so forth. And I'm into this series, which we've given the overall title of Take Up Your Cross to, which was yesterday's session, kind of an invitation and challenge to figure out what our issues in life may be that prevent us from being as faithful and effective in service as we could, and take those up and get on with working on them. Today, we're here to think our way into and through an issue that I discovered with many seminary students, at least, is a very troubling, problematic thing. I think there are many redemptive possibilities in this area, but it certainly deserves to be looked at, and the issue, as you can tell from the board behind me, is shame. And I want to think with you today about those ways in which shame is healthy, on the one hand. It's not just a totally bad word. There are some healthy manifestations of shame. People who are utterly without shame are not very whole, healthy people. But shame in its toxic, troubling forms is a very damaging thing. Very limiting and painful in some extreme form sometimes. We're not here just to talk about shame sort of in its most dramatic manifestations, although there are some rather dramatic ways shame pops out, but also the ways in which shame, fairly common, ordinary stuff, is part of our everyday lives and is something I think that all of us have to cope with and face and whatnot. Let me start us off with a poem, if I can, by a poet who I really don't know, Vern Ritsala, whose only work I know is this one, but it is so moving and so good that I try to use it as often as I can. Title is simply Shame, and I like it because it blends together in so many ways the common and the extraordinary sort of manifestations of shame. This is the shame of the woman whose hand hides her smile because her teeth are so bad. Not the grand self-hate that leads some to razors or pills or swan dives off beautiful bridges, however tragic that is. This is the shame of being yourself, of being ashamed of where you live and what your father's paycheck lets you eat and wear. This is the shame of the fat and the bald. The unbearable blush of acne. The shame of having no lunch money and pretending you're not hungry. This is the shame of concealed sickness, diseases too expensive to afford that offer only their cold one-way ticket out. This is the shame of being ashamed. The self-disgust of the cheap wine drunk, the lassitude that makes junk accumulate, the shame that tells you there is another way to live, but you are too dumb to find it. This is the real shame, the damned shame, the crying shame, the shame that's criminal, the shame that of knowing words like glory are not in your vocabulary, though they litter the Bibles you're still paying for. This is the shame of not knowing how to read and pretending that you do. This is the shame that makes you afraid to leave your house, the shame of food stamps at the supermarket when the clerk shows impatience as you fumble with the change. This is the shame of dirty underwear, the shame of pretending your father works in an office as God intended all men to do. This is the shame of asking friends to let you off in front of the one nice house in the neighborhood and waiting in the shadows until they drive away before walking to the gloom of your house. This is the shame at the end of the mania for owning things, the shame of no heat in winter, the shame of eating cat food, the unholy shame of dreaming of a new house and car, and the shame of knowing how cheap such dreams are. Well, let me follow that with a prayer from Ted Loader's Guerrillas of Grace called "Touch Me Deeply So That I Will Find a Sense of Self." Let us pray. O ingenious God, I rejoice in your creation and pray that your spirit touch me so deeply that I will find a sense of self which makes me glad to be who I am, and yet restless at being anything less than I can become. Make me simple enough not to be confused by disappointments, clear enough not to mistake busyness for freedom, honest enough not to expect truth to be painless, brave enough not to sing all my songs in private, compassionate enough to get in trouble, humble enough to admit trouble and seek help, joyful enough to celebrate all of it, myself and others and you through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. A little line I meant to share yesterday that I think I forgot to. One of our senior students last year preached a sermon in chapel, and he used this as kind of the framework, and I thought it fits so well for what we're doing this week. He said, some people come to the fountain of knowledge to drink, others only to gargle. And I think that's kind of the challenge I want to put before you this week, is come to these issues, come to these biblical texts, come to these ideas, and drink. See what you can really get out of it. It's easy to come to these things and sort of gargle, and we dabble a little bit, but we don't really embrace what may be there for us. And I don't want garglers. I want drinkers. I put up here a few books on shame. I hope you can read my handwriting. I was running out of time, so I scribbled them down. I can explain later if you want. But the book by Lewis Smedes, Shame and Grace, is a particularly useful one. It's written from a good theological perspective, and one of the few books, actually, until I get the time to write something myself here, I hope, in the next few years, but one of the few books that treats shame in a theological kind of way. He's got a nice quote in that book, and let me just share. It's a one-sentence quote. He says, "One person described her shame to me as a knife cutting into the heart of me just when I'm feeling good about myself." Now, that doesn't capture it all, but it says something of how shame may intersect with us. Let me share here at the beginning just a personal note and move us into the topic that way. Somebody has said that all doctoral dissertations are autobiographical. Nobody spends all that time writing, working on something like that unless you have a personal interest in what this is all about. And I did my doctoral dissertation on shame and baptism. Shame and baptism. I'll talk about that by the end here, I think, how these two intersect. Very interestingly, only later did I sort of think this through. On my confirmation day, it was the custom in my home church that my pastor gave to each confirmand a biblical verse to kind of his characterization of you. Well, mine was Romans 1:16, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ." And of course, the whole book of Romans goes on to talk about baptism, so I was set up for this from way back. But I have a very clear memory of a Sunday evening in the fall of 1981 when I first began graduate work at Princeton Seminary. I was taking a course on, two courses actually, one on the life cycle, where we were reading Erik Erikson on shame, and another course on sort of the human predicament, sin, and so forth. And we got assigned to read this book called On Shame and the Search for Identity. And on this Sunday evening at the Princeton Public Library on the second floor over in the right-hand wing, I could take you almost, I think, to the exact study, Carol, where I was sitting reading chapter 2 of this book about shame. And I have a very clear memory of at one point just sort of laying Helen Marilyn's book down and a kind of aha moment when I said, I think this book is talking about my experience. And it's not just my experience. Something here resonates with lived experience as I've both lived it and bumped up against it, and I was hooked. I mean, I was off onto digging out everything I could find on shame, and somewhat to my surprise, finding that there wasn't that much literature on shame as you might have thought 15 years ago. This book by Helen Merrill Lynn had been written in the late 50s and was still one of the very few. Now, in the last 15 years, we've had an explosion of literature about shame, a lot of very good stuff, most of it from a psychological perspective, and not enough of it, in my opinion, from a theological perspective, so we'll try to do some theology with that. But this book by Helen Merrill Lynn on shame and the search for identity, it took a while for people to catch on to that book, I think, but she really began what we now know as the popular explosion of the John Bradshaws and the Luce Meads and so forth, surfacing the ideas for a general reading public. You didn't have to be a psychoanalytic expert to appreciate what she was saying. And so the thing that she seemed to discover that others had been missing up to that point was guilt did not explain everything that it was supposed to explain. Up to that point, through the middle part of the 20th century, both theologians and psychologists alike, certainly tried and true Freudians, thought that guilt, and you know, whether real or neurotic, explained a lot, maybe everything, about human behavior. Helen Merrill Lynn worked on that, and she said, there's just too much human experience that doesn't really fit with people feeling guilty. It's something else. And she thought it was shame, and anyway, we were off and running. We'll talk about some comparisons and distinctions between shame and guilt today. You can make your own decision about whether this makes any sense to you. But let's get into shame here then, under the heading I put up here on Roman numeral 2, healthy shame and toxic shame, which is a way of saying there's shame and then there's shame. I mean, there's more than one way to think about this. And here I'm borrowing some ideas from Lewis Mead's book, where he talks about these, and a little bit from John Bradshaw's book on healing the shame that binds you. Both of those are very readable, very good books, thorough books, not just fluff, but real substance, but accessible to the reading public. To get at this healthy and toxic shame, we have to think in some theological categories here that Smeeds invites us into. He talks about what he calls, on the one hand, our true selves, and on the other hand, our actual selves, and tries to describe a difference. I think in some ways this is very close to what Paul Tillich talked about. Our true self is what Tillich called our essential self. The self that God created us to be, the self that we see when we look at Jesus, humanity in its wholest, most healthy form. The actual self, says Smeeds, is, in my opinion, kind of what Tillich talked about as the existential self, the fallen self, what we actually live out day in, day out. We don't live like Jesus every day. We don't live the full potential of our humanity because of our fallenness. The true self, then, is a kind of template, you know. This is the model self. But the actual self, you know, you never, when you trace it out, it never quite matches the template, you know. It's always, the edges don't quite match, no matter how hard we try, no matter what happens. There's this gap we have to live with between the actuality of what we are and the true self, the essential self that God would like us to be. Now, what Smeeds points out is that if I never feel any sort of shame at all, then I've either become totally divine or totally corrupt. And he says our best intentions tell us that basically we're neither of those. We're neither totally divine nor totally corrupt. The awareness of shame keeps us in touch with this difference between what we actually are and what we truly would like to be and truly God would like us to be. In that sense, these kinds of feelings of shame that get us in touch with the discrepancy of our shortcomings is shame that we basically deserve. It's helpful to us. Healthy shame, John Bradshaw says, is what lets us know that we are limited and we are not God. And that's a pretty useful feeling to have. It's not helpful in life to run around thinking that, to confuse your own creaturehood with God being the creator. I had to do garbology this morning, so I missed Walt's Bible study about God being, how did you title it? If somebody's got to be in charge, why not God?
Better God in charge than somebody else.
Yes, right. if I run around thinking that I'm in charge, this is not a very happy universe. And eventually I'm not going to be a very happy person, because I will be continually disappointed that I can't quite make thing, you know, everything work out the way that I would like to. So if we're shameless in this sense, then we've really got no sense of boundaries in life. You know, we begin to think our influence and our control and our authority extends everywhere, and that's just not the case. If you know anything about Erik Erikson in his 8 stages of human development, he locates the issue of shame as developing in the second stage of the life cycle, very early, sometime around age 2 to 4, around in there, 2 to 3 maybe. And he puts shame over against the development of feelings of autonomy, and says those have to, you know, you have to get a relatively healthy balance between those things. You want to be relatively more autonomous than shame-filled. In other words, you want to have a healthy, autonomous sense about who you are. But if you're totally autonomous without any sense of shame, this is not a good thing. Your little bit of shame keeps your autonomy in check and keeps you from thinking basically that you're God. So Bradshaw says this kind of shame is like a yellow light. It in effect tells us to be cautious, you know, proceed, go ahead, but be a little bit careful. Don't overassume that you're more than you are. It's what gives us basically the permission to be human, so that we don't have to act like God, don't have to act like a person who, you know, can do everything for myself and I don't need anybody else's help. That would be purely and perfectly autonomous. And nobody is that, and nobody really wants to be. Healthy shame, then, is what should cause us to take a deeper look at who we are, the discrepancy of our fallenness. We are not all that God would have us to be or all that we could be. It should help us admit our limitations, confess our sin, seek the grace that we need, and move on. A kind of yellow light. Not a green light that says, you know, just go for it, doesn't matter. And not a red light that shuts us down completely, but a kind of cautionary word that lets us be mindful and then go ahead. Now, that's healthy shame. The shame, Smeeds would say, that we deserve to experience. But on the other hand, there's this very painful phenomena of toxic shame, or what Lou Smeeds calls the shame we don't deserve to have. This we might think of as toxic shame, a kind of good gift gone bad. Shame, basically, is helpful. But in its toxic forms, it's deadly, it's killing. It's not just a reminder of our humanness, it's something that makes us less than human. Not a yellow light, but a red light that gets us stuck and unable to proceed at all. It's a voice, says Lou Smeeds, this toxic shame, from what he calls a false self. And I gotta remember, he's talked about your true self, what God would have you to be, the actual self, what you are as you live out day to day. And then he says, we have this voice of a false self. Some kind of image of ourself that pretends to be a true self, but is not at all God-given. It's a false self put together out of all kind of false ideas, a false self that convinces us that we cannot possibly be acceptable unless we meet the standards of all of these false ideals. He lifts up 3 things, Smeeds does, I find them pretty compelling, as a common sources that fuel this false self. He says, first of all, there's the secular culture that we all live in, which teaches us that the way we get accepted or find acceptance is conforming to the world's stereotypes. You know, you got to drive the right kind of car and buy the right kind of clothes and smoke the right kind of cigarettes or whatever. And that's deadly. Second thing he says is graceless religion. That's a little painful to hear, you know, if you're a religious person, but I think he's right. When religion becomes something that teaches us we get accepted by conforming to the rules rather than by a gracious God, You know, and all forms of religion, Christianity certainly no exception, are susceptible to this perversion that they become graceless and very demanding, law-oriented forms of religion, and that fuels a false sense of self. And finally, he touches on the fact that if we've had unaccepting parents, this doesn't help either. Parents have, I mean, now that I am a parent, I understand, I have a complicity in all this too. That's what we're going to talk about tomorrow. The problem with parents is they had parents. And we're all in this fallen world together. But there's this interesting situation that parents often put us in, you know. They subtly let us know that we have to be very good to earn their love. And then they find a way of reminding us that we're not quite good enough to do that. I don't think some parents do set out really to damage their children and manage their own issues, you know, on the fragile egos of their children, but most don't. Most send out those kind of double messages, not even realizing quite what's going on there, and we have to, you know, sort it out later on. Well, that's partly why we're here. One really important point to note about this false self, it can have very opposite appearances. On the one hand, the false self can look like the real super achiever, you know, that person who just does everything, is everything, constantly in motion, constantly working on things. And at the other extreme, it's the sort of chronic underachiever. The point is, a life without any grace in it drives us to one of those extremes, that we either have to do everything or we're convinced we can't do anything. That's the way the false self teaches us to live. And that's where shame really begins to enter the picture. Living at either one of those extremes, the super-duper overachiever or the chronic miserable underachiever, is really living with toxic shame. You're either more than human, the super overachiever, or you're less than human, the chronic underachiever, but you're not human. You're not anything like a true self or even an actual self. Let me pause there, just see if these distinctions we're working out here on healthy shame and toxic shame and true self, actual self, false self, does that make some sense? Can you resonate with that or want to add anything to it here?
Is Robinson Crusoe ever ashamed? In other words, is shame a social phenomenon, or does it take place in society and in a community? Am I ever ashamed if I'm all by myself, if I never have to face another person? Now, that's a highly theoretical question, but I guess my interest in this is to suggest anyway that shame is a way also of social control or social molding. Mm-hmm. But it sort of comes to us from the outside.
Well, what we're going to get to here is some, especially when we talk about shame and guilt, some distinctions. Shame is much more, I'd bark up your tree here. Shame is very much a relational phenomena. We can experience shame when there's not another person in the room. But we experience that shame because we can imagine how others would look at us. And in a sense, because we all have a relationship with ourselves. Now that gets to be pretty complicated psychology and so forth. We don't need to dabble in here. But generally, I think we know what we mean when we say that. I mean, as a human being, I have the ability to kind of stand outside myself and look at myself, parts of myself. I mean, however wrong Freud may have been, he came up with something fairly insightful when he suggested that we have at least these three kind of parts that relate to each other and make up a human being. That's a pretty useful concept. It is very relational, because one of the things that shame is about is having this feeling that I don't measure up in the eyes of other people. And of course, it is a very socially controlling phenomenon, much stronger in some cultures than others. Our Western culture, especially as we know it in the United States, doesn't rely much on shame to control anybody's behavior. You go to an Eastern culture, Japan, China, and so forth, you'll find shame is a much more highly motivating factor to keep people's behavior in line. Now, there are some healthy aspects of that, some pretty damaging aspects to that too. I think if you look back in the history of religion in America to colonial times, we'll find that shame was a much more important part of the picture. In one sense, happily, we've gotten away from that, but in another sense, you look around and you say, well, it's pretty shameless autonomy that we see in a lot of ways. I sit and wonder, how can these people put this stuff on television? I mean, is there no shame? Well, there isn't, and would that there were a little more, in a sense. But of course, what we get when we work that kind of bargain is we always run the risk of heaping this sense of law on people, the shoulds and the oughts and the musts and the heavy sense of graceless control that leads to pretty unhealthy personal development. Well, let me just touch a couple things. I don't want to get too deeply into this. A few characteristics on toxic shame that may help a bit. And here I'm about 0.3 there or something. Back to Helen Merrill Lynn's book for a moment. She actually lifted up 6 or 7 things. I'll just touch on a couple. She said one characteristic of this kind of shame, she didn't call it healthy and toxic. She pretty much thought it was all toxic. But she said exposure, particularly when we're exposed unexpectedly, is a key producer of this sort of painful toxic shame. We get exposed in a vulnerable moment. I mean, the literal thing of, you know, kind of being caught with your pants down. We don't expect to be seen this way, and then all of a sudden, there we are, doing something, saying something stupid. You know how that is. You've told a joke, and as soon as it was out of your mouth, you knew that this was not the place to tell that kind of a story. You know, you just wish you could take it back, but you can't. And the feeling that we often have at that moment, you've heard people say, you know, I felt so small. I wish I could have just disappeared, you know. I wanted to crawl through a knothole. In fact, what physiologically happens to us is we blush, which is the body's way of trying to cover us up, right? It's like a mask to hide behind. There is a physiological dimension to all this too. But more than most other emotions, shame involves the unexpected happening to us. In the grade school classroom, remember, you know, you're passing that note, you're writing on your desk, you're doing something you shouldn't have been doing, you didn't think the teacher was paying attention, then all of a sudden it's Mr. So-and-so, you know, would you please tell us what you're doing? Oh my gosh, you know. And so that whole business of sending a child to the corner, to sit in the corner with a dunce cap on, was all about shame, right? You remove a person from their community, it's a relational thing, and in the eyes of their peers, who can now condescendingly look down on you as you sit in the corner with the dunce cap on, you're singled out for special ridicule. Well, that's controlling people's behavior with shame. Real problem with that is it doesn't work. We'll talk about that, because being shamed in that way creates for us, most of the time, a deep feeling of anger and rage. And that kind of anger has to go somewhere. And we either lash out at other people or we take it out on ourselves. And those are not real healthy ways to process that. There are other ways of correcting people's behavior, I would contend, without shaming them publicly. But another point about toxic shame is, in a way that a lot of other feelings don't, this kind of shame involves everything that we are. My whole self comes into question. It's not just a question of what have I done. It's really, what have I done? What kind of person am I that I would have said that, done that, thought that, been that? You know, if it was just a question of what did I do? Well, next time I'll do it differently, or I'll go back and apologize for what I've done, or I'll work some kind of retribution. But shame gets us caught in that moment where we say, oh my gosh, you know, I am that kind of a person. It deals with everything that I am. And then one last thing. Well, I should say too, this is why guilt is often a very preferable Eric Erickson said that we basically in our culture don't know much or deal much with shame because it's so early and so often confused with guilt. And actually, that's pretty much our preference. Guilt. When you're guilty of doing something wrong, you can always undo it, try to do it better, apologize for what you've done. But when you have the sense that you are ashamed and that your whole self is caught up in this, it's a rather helpless feeling. What, you know, I was just being myself, and yet I have this painful awareness that the self that I am and the self that I could be are just so far apart. How do I start to close that gap? Well, one other characteristic. Shame is a very heavy kind of experience, a very difficult and painful thing to even talk about. And therefore, there's a kind of a shame about our shame. Now, here we are. I mean, we're, 15 minutes into this session, and I've taught a whole class in seminary on shame, and I do lectures and whatnot on shame. I don't ever presume to think that, you know, we're at a point here where we've really even delved very deeply into our shame. I would guess that some of the things we're into here are raising up for all of us some, you know, shameful memories, some things we'd like to keep hidden, and so forth. But I'm not inviting you to talk about that. I mean, if you want to, feel free, but I have no expectation. We'd probably, in some sense, be unhealthy if we bared our souls here. I mean, that would be kind of shameless, in a sense. And so we're in this odd position here where we're trying to talk about something, yet we know it's very hard to talk about. And even to raise the issue creates a kind of shame about our shame. By definition, shame means we're exposed when we don't want to be exposed. And so to choose to talk about our shame means we're choosing to expose ourselves probably in a pretty unflattering sort of a way that's not easy to do. I just point that out and say, in spite of that, I'm interested in helping people work on this issue, think about it, try to discern where it may be something that in each of our own lives we need to pay attention to, and maybe create some kind of safe and comfortable space where we can at least make a little bit of a foray into talking about this, and so that we don't have to go around our whole life feeling like this is so heavy and so difficult and so painful that I can never talk to anybody about it. Let me pause there again, see if that raises up anything you want to toss out on the table. After I've just said it probably won't, but I'll ask you anyway.
You just said it'd probably be unhealthy for you.
Well, one of the things that I find interesting is the different level of guilt or conscience that different people have, and some of the new research that's being done in terms of people being born without the same amount of conscience as another person. And it seems like, you know, like I teach, and there are some children that, you know, will feel guilty over something really, really small,
yeah,
and feel exposed really quickly, and other children, you know, that have a different level of that. And I think, you know, in looking at myself or looking at other people, to just kind of see it as a whole and see if there are differences between the level of guilt or shame that a person feels just innate inside of them and from who they are.
Mm-hmm. It has an awful lot, I think, to do with your family of origin and whether that was graceful or graceless, helpful or made you feel helpless. I don't know, this obviously isn't the time to try to sort all that out. But it is interesting to look at the various manifestations of how people have to live this out. Yet, I guess in a sense, I would contend that we have an awful lot in common as human fallen human beings around this shame issue that probably we don't get very many opportunities to talk frankly about. And if we could find some freedom to do that, I think we'd all be a little more healthy. We might start to see that gap close a little bit. Part of what's going on there is people needing to be self-protective. And so those who would appear not to have much of a sense of shame or guilt perhaps are the more guilty and shame-ridden, but we have to defend ourselves somehow, and we'll talk about that with this diagram over here in terms of ways that we do that. Well, a word on shame. Yeah, question, comment?
Question, yeah.
Yeah.
You were talking about the overachiever, underachiever, mm-hmm. The extremes, that type of thing. I wonder if you could help me identify maybe like common phrases of when you're around people, like you're involved in people's lives, and you may hear individuals make particular comments. And not only know how to read them, but being able, so that you might be able to identify them as, you know, this person has some real shame issues.
Yeah. Let me, let's go right to this diagram. We'll skip over the guilt and shame for a minute, or if we don't come back to it, we don't. But let's go to this for a second. This is supposed to be kind of a circle, like circular deal here, like this. This comes out of a book by Donald Nathanson, Shame and Pride. He's a real heavy-hitting, deep-thinking psychoanalyst in New York City. But amazingly, he wrote a book that you can read and understand with a clever diagram, I think. He calls this thing the compass of shame, and his point is that at the center, the central emotion in this diagram is shame. And he suggests that the ways that we defend against our sense of shame tend to cluster into four different directions, kind of like points on a compass. And I guess my own observations tend to make me think he's on to something useful here. On one axis, he says, we either withdraw or avoid. That's one set of possibilities. And then the other way is we either attack ourselves or we attack other people. So I guess one way to respond to your comment, rather than just verbal cues, look for the behavioral cues in yourself as well as other people. Here's what he's talking about. Withdrawal, he says, is having the full impact of a shame experience hit us so strongly that the way we deal with it is just that sort of desire to become invisible. You know, we just shrink up, we withdraw, we shut down, we don't say anything, we try to disappear. We get probably very depressed is one manifestation of that. I think that's a question that should always be asked when we're around someone or working with someone who may appear to be very depressed, is gently to, you know, inquire about some shame issues. You know, has something happened that was particularly painful, a difficult relational thing, some sense of, you know, being exposed, you came off in a way that you didn't ever think you'd come off, something like that. The opposite pole on that is avoidance. Which is an attempt, Nathanson would say, to insulate ourselves against the experience of shame so that we never have to deal with something like withdrawal. We try to cut it off at the pass, in a sense. And there he lifts up things like the workaholic, the overachiever, the person who tries to stay so busy and accomplished that you never have to worry about getting caught in an awkward moment. He has some other interesting examples too, like substance abuse, he would say, is a avoidance way of dealing with shame. We introduce some chemical into our bodies to give us an altered state where we're not conscious then of our shame moments. Or, he also had an interesting example, plastic surgery as an avoidance mechanism. Now, a few years ago, that would have seemed kind of weird to me, but then I did ministry in Southern California for 6 years and had a plastic surgeon in my congregation. This guy was making a lot of money and was a very good guy, too. I mean, he did a lot of charitable plastic surgery down in Mexico and that sort of thing, but he was making a lot of money off people who thought that, you know, they had the wrong kind of nose or the wrong size breasts or too big of a rear end or whatever, and that their way of dealing with their shame about that was to avoid it, basically, by physically altering their appearance. Well, it doesn't have to go to the extreme of plastic surgery. That's kind of at the end of the spectrum of ultimate ways to deal with this. But we all avoid a sense of who we really are cosmetically by doing all sorts of things. And that's another way. And when you see people into pretty overt attempts to do that, you have to wonder. Well, on the other polarity, he suggests we have the attack self and attack others. Attacking yourself is again an attempt to control the shame experience, but in a somewhat more overt acting out way. But what we're usually saying in this, when we choose this strategy, is I'm going to do it to myself before somebody else gets a chance to do it to me. This is the person who is very, very self-deprecating. You know, will quickly say, I can never do anything right. You know me, I'm a klutz, whatever. Again, that you may have a sense that that's the shame drives that kind of behavior. And we've all caught ourselves doing that too. The illusion is, if I attack myself, at least I'm in control of the attack. And that somehow feels maybe a little less painful and a little more manageable than having somebody else shame me or attack me. And then, of course, at the other opposite extreme is attacking others before they get a chance to shame me. That's an attempt to control our shame by doing it to others before they can do it to us. We'll shame them before they get a chance to shame us. This is your classic schoolyard bully, you know, who really has a very inadequate sense of self, but in order to cover up for that has to pick on other people. I think this is where we usually see domestic violence occurring over here. People who attack others in a domestic situation very frequently have their own issues of insufficiency and shame and so forth that drive that. Very interesting example from a couple years ago. You may remember this person, Colin Ferguson. He was just finally tried and sentenced, but he was a man on the Long Island Railroad who went through at rush hour, pulled a gun, and just indiscriminately started shooting people. They found in his pocket after this a note that he was apparently intending to deliver. He had been trying to get some sort of workman's compensation claim settled with the state of New York, and it seems like it was a spurious claim and, you know, not really founded in any kind of truth, but he felt he had a legitimate gripe, apparently. For whatever reason, he kept having to deal with certain Asian Americans who worked in the workman's compensation office in the state of New York. Coincidence, I think. But somehow he took that extremely personally. I mean, he was not emotionally all there, of course. In the note that they found in his pocket, he said, you know, blaming these Asian Americans who he'd been dealing with, he said something like, "I'll see to it that they never have the opportunity to shame me again." Now, what was interesting was when he went through the train car, he shot indiscriminately. He wasn't just looking for Asian Americans. I mean, that's where, you know, he really had a deep problem. And then, of course, he was his own lawyer at his trial to try to defend himself. And it was Abraham Lincoln who said, you know, if you have a person who defends himself as their own lawyer has a fool for a client, I think that was the way that went. But in any event, little glimpse at how a person who felt that he had been extremely shamed went to very extreme lengths to attack other people, in some sense, to prevent future feelings of shame. That's an extreme example, but, you know, there it sits. Well, we have to think, Nathanson would say that each of us probably has one of those four strategies that we generally tend to do first. And not that we don't visit all the points on the compass at one time or another, but we generally become very accomplished at one of these methods, a coping mechanism that works well for us, and that's a pattern that we fall into. Now, one of the questions we have to ask is, when we catch ourselves in that, how do we go back and say, you know, is there a healthier way to deal with this? Now, I've introduced the idea of guilt kind of around the circle. Here's the point with that. I think we can say that the things that we do that we would appropriately say we are guilty of are really wrong actions that we commit in an attempt to deal with our shameful feelings. We are guilty of doing things that hurt ourselves and others in an unhealthy attempt to deal with our shame. At least that's how I'm trying to work it out.
Give an example.
Yeah. Well, like domestic violence, for instance. I'm guilty of violating some other person. It's appropriate to say I am guilty of that. But what drives that may be a very painful shame, you know, sense of shame and inadequacy, and I have to get my good feeling out of being stronger than somebody else. Withdrawal, in a sense, you can say, is something that is sinful, and we are guilty of it. To the extent that it's living a false reality that says there's not enough grace in the world to sustain me to face these issues, I have to circle my little wagons here and just pull into my shell. Attacking yourself is obviously not helpful, especially if that goes to extreme lengths of real physical harm to yourself. Well, all I want to say with that, I guess, is hopefully that helps us see how complicated all this is, you know? And guilt is not something easily and quickly to moralize about, although it's appropriate, you know, to talk about sin and guilt and so forth. But a lot of things drive that, and we need some understanding for what that's all about. Another way I guess I would choose to talk about this is to say, again, I'm back to Tillich a little bit, one of my favorite theologians. I think when we're talking about shame here, in a sense, this is a manifestation of what Tillich meant when he talked about sin in capital letters, as opposed to what he called sins. I'll just put it in small case letters for the contrast, not in any way to suggest that it's less important, but sins in the plural. And by that he meant there is the captivity, what we confess in the confession in the LBW week in, week out, that I am in bondage to sin and cannot free myself. That sin with a capital S in the singular. What that bondage to sin causes us to do is commit all kinds of particular sins as a way of dealing with it, which is not helpful and not healthy. It gets us in all kinds of trouble. We would be better to seek grace, you know, that can give us a sense of freedom from our bondage rather than trying to escape that through wrongful, hurtful, harmful actions. What does that do to you? Make any kind of sense?
Well, at the risk of doing anything dangerous or unhealthy, I wondered if I could quickly talk about my experience with shame, and then I think it might help to illuminate a little bit. Someone's asking for a specific example. My primary strategy is avoidance, and has been, you know, just to be busy. And in dealing with, finally, shame was the thing that came to really explain a lot about what had gone on in my life, basically never feeling good enough. So having to do all these things, never feeling like that was enough, that sort of thing. And basically covering up that sense of self that was, for whatever reason, from any family of origin and other reason, which I won't get into, was very deep, and I couldn't get out of it. And what I've found, now that I've dealt with a lot of that, it still comes back, obviously. It's still going to be my primary coping mechanism. And shame is something so complex that I don't think you ever fully deal with it. Because there are some parts of it that are healthy, as you've said. But I found now that at this point in my life, I can see when I'm doing that avoidance thing, when I'm getting really busy and I'm scattered and I'm going in a zillion directions, I can say, what am I avoiding? Wait a minute. And I can slow down and you know, kind of yell with myself and go to the beach and walk and find out what that's about. So just, if that helps, I hope that helps. It's a personal example of dealing with addictions.
If I can just link that to what we were talking about yesterday, I mean, that's for me a helpful example of, you know, seeking the grace you need at the foot of your cross, I mean, at where God is with us in our suffering, and not assuming that we're going to find happiness and grace by getting real busy and avoiding the issue, running around away from our problems.
Brad, one of the things that intrigued me about your diagram out there is that...
It's my diagram if it works. If it doesn't, it's Donald Nathan's.
But I think it's a good intrigue that I have, is that you have shame, the central emotion, and then radiating outward is guilt on the perimeter, as it were. And it intrigues me because if you read the story of the fall into sin, the first experience that the first parents felt after they had eaten of the forbidden fruit was shame. They suddenly exposed. They suddenly knew they were naked. They felt ashamed, and then they went and hid. First emotion, the first response upon doing it. Only subsequently, then, when Yahweh comes in, into the garden, Adam, where are you? Well, we're off in the bushes here. Why? Well, we're naked. Well, who told you you were naked? Well, and then, yeah, then the guilt comes.
We get, that's a nice story because it hits just about on all these, I think. First thing they do is withdraw. They go hide, right? Which in a sense is getting busy and avoiding too. But then, of course, quickly we see the attack other. Well, my fault, she did it, you know, I blame somebody else. I suppose there's some attack self in there too somewhere, I don't know. But yeah, I want to talk about that. Well, we're into it, I don't need to wait. Got it down here somewhere, Genesis 3, yeah.
Did they feel shame before the confrontation?
Well, if we look at the story, remember that the first word we get in Genesis 1:27, I think, something like that, is they were naked and not ashamed, which sets us up that by implication, the text does not actually say they felt ashamed, but we know because they were naked and not ashamed that when they're trying to cover themselves up after what they've done, that indeed, you know, they are. Now, you have to also think about what is the nature of the sin being described in that story. It's not just the simple eating of a piece of fruit off the tree. I mean, it's not just that they broke the rules, although they did break the rules. Much more profound story than that. And Bonhoeffer has a nice, one of the few theological treatments on shame in a section of his book on ethics, where he points out that what really is being violated here is the divine-human relationship. They're basically telling God to go kiss off. You know, we don't need you. It's that shameless disposition where they, I mean, what is the temptation after all? You can be like God. You can be fully autonomous. No balance of autonomy and shame, to use Erickson's terms. You can be all of this and get rid of that altogether. Well, that is not the true self, because the true self is a self in relationship to God that has the appropriate understanding of creature and creator. What that is really a false self that says humans are God. And just history is replete with examples of when humans have thought that way and all the trouble that, of course, we get ourselves into. Now, yeah?
I was just wondering if you were going to get to Roy's question about whether they had shame before.
Sorry. Thank you. I think that shame was the earlier sensation, I guess I would say. Before they realized what they were guilty of, they had that instantaneous, terrible, awesome feeling. Well, I mean, they had. We all have. That Adam and Eve story is all of our story, right? We don't want to just locate that in ancient history somewhere. This is really the collective description of all of humanity we're dealing with here. That terrible, sudden, awful moment of exposure where we literally say, oh my God, you know. The psychological part of that, where Erickson becomes so extremely useful, is if he's right, and I think enough study has been done to say he's pretty much on the right track, he suggests as human beings we develop the capacity for shame at stage 2. The capacity to experience guilt doesn't come until about a year or so later at stage 3, where the issues are initiative versus guilt. In other words, about a 3 to 4 year old learning to take appropriate initiative, do things for him or herself, but it's a boundary deal, you know, how far can I press? And then learning when you press the boundaries too far, you trespass, you violate the rules, and you feel guilty for that. He says that, you know, the sense of shame we have as children is because we get that look from people. And what guilt really is all about is when the look gets internalized. You have a bad feeling even when nobody's looking at you because you know you've broken the rules, you've gone too far. So I think just that's an interesting psychological thing that comes right together with the theology and suggests in an observational kind of way, we have the capacity for shame before we have the capacity for guilt. It's somehow a more basic emotion, I think, and therefore deserves this kind of pretty in-depth treatment. Let me get to baptism, man. I'm jumping around, but that's okay. Bonhoeffer points out that the redemptive part of the Genesis story there in Genesis 3 is that in spite of the punishment that is now meted out, there is wrapped in and through that a very gracious action that God extends, which is to clothe these two naked people, to give them some cover, to help them with their sense of exposure, right? They get garments made out of skins, and yes, they're thrown out of Eden, but at least not naked and utterly shamed. And Bonhoeffer sees in that the clear signal of a gracious God reaching out to a fallen world to restore and to lift up. And I think we can then just trace that theme on through and say that by the time we get to the New Testament, we see in baptism the sacramentalization of this sort of grace. One example, the life of Augustine. If you know anything about Augustine, here was a guy who had pretty much maxed out on shame. He had dabbled in about every shameful thing you could get into, from sexual indiscretion to all sorts of inappropriate lying and deception and arrogance and so forth. His conversion experience, when he has this moment in the garden where he hears this voice saying, take and read, and there are scriptures, and he lifts up and he turns to Romans chapter 13, verse 14, and he reads, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh. Well, many have suggested that why this connects so deeply with Augustine is he understands the opportunity to be covered in his shame, that Jesus can be put on and become a new self for him, a redemptive self, which is very much like the baptismal imagery that Paul uses in Galatians 3. As many of you as were baptized into Christ have clothed yourself or put on Christ Jesus. We know that in the ancient church, when people were baptized, they were baptized naked. Adults even, good heavens. A kind of shameful acknowledgement of their fallen condition. But the first thing that happened, of course, when they came out of the waters of baptism were they got this wonderful new white baptismal garment to put on. They were covered. A symbol and a sacramental way of saying there is a new identity. God looks at you in a new way. God does not consider your shame as the fundamental core part of what you are. God now sees you as a true self for Jesus' sake, even though your actual self still does have stuff you have to work out. Anyway, that's why I think that baptism is such a powerful theological tool to use to work with when you're dealing with shame, your own shame or somebody else's shame. That daily reminder that we are clothed, that we are washed, that we are put on, that we have put on a new identity. Shame is an experience that calls our identity into question, that leaves us saying, who am I? How could I have done this? And theologically, what baptism is all about is saying, this is who you are. This is what God sees when God looks at you. Not the shameful self you are so painfully in touch with, but a redeemed self that is wholly acceptable in the eyes of God. I'm out of things to say. We're almost out of time, but let's see if that touches off anything here for anybody.
Can you go over part four, briefly?
Oh, guilt and shame a little bit? Yeah, I think we touched on a lot of these things along the way, but one thing, we didn't really say anything about punishment and abandonment. For instance, boundaries and ideals. Guilt is about the breaking of boundaries. Shame is about the falling short of my sense of what I could be, my ideal self. The fears that stand behind guilt and shame